November, he has enough to begin with. Thank you for veiling yourself. And just to indicate to you how this will work, I'm Joan Phumps. I chair the Committee on Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. These are members of the same committee, Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. And people sitting at the back are observers doing work of one kind and another, or members outside of Parliament itself. So we would like to begin as soon as possible. Do you have some water? No, and perhaps someone can just ensure. So just perhaps make sure you're comfortable with your water, then we can start. Different members will be asking you different questions. Please just feel relaxed. We're here to encourage you to tell us a little bit more about yourself. And how you respond to the questions will also assist us. Thank you very much. So let's start off by briefly, Mr. Humer, if you could give us and share with us your past experience and also indicate the contribution in the light of that as to what you would make to the Commission. What would be your contribution to the Commission? And what, in your own opinion, would be the main criteria for the chairperson? So the first thing is, using your past experience, tell us how that will relate to what contribution you'll make in the Commission. And then secondly, in your opinion, what is the main criteria for the chairperson? Go ahead. When you're ready, just press the button. That perhaps I was remiss. We have here the Honourable Jerome van Schalkwyk, the Honourable Arumo Kalako, the whip of the committee sitting next to her. Then we have the Honourable Dean MacPherson sitting at the back there. And to his left, the Honourable Jordan Hill Lewis. Thank you. So go ahead.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee. As stated, my name is William Elias Humer. As far as my past experience is concerned and how it will contribute to the National Lotteries Commission, I am trained as a lawyer with degrees BProc, LLB, and Masters in Law, and I completed my coursework cum laude for the doctoral degree of law, and thereafter I got interested in corporate governance and the general business world, where I did a diploma in corporate governance with Henley Management and a number of other certificates in financial management, organization design, culture change, performance management, project management, and also other competency-based certificates. My training initially as a lawyer has helped me to be able to be analytical, to be able to make a contribution of a different nature, in the sense that as a lawyer you're expected to uphold the highest standards of ethics, morality, and integrity. And also my experience in the business world has taught me also to be political leader in the sense that you have to give leadership, you have to give direction, and you have to oversee the attainment of the goals and objectives of the institution and also foster teamwork. I have enormous experience in the country and outside the country. I have worked outside the country for Accenture, which is an international technology and management consulting firm listed in the New York Stock Exchange. I was among the founding partners. Originally were 12 worldwide, 1,200 worldwide, 12 in South Africa. And I had distinguished myself by also being able to sit in the regional EXCO for EMEA, Europe, Middle East, and Africa, where I was a partner responsible for competencies. That is a significant achievement, being a South African in a global space. And locally, I have also served in a number of organizations, including Group 5, including a number of technology and management consulting firms. And at the moment, I'm also chairing a number of trust and other boards, including amongst notable ones is the Lanseria Airport, as well as the National Lotteries Participant Trust, which is a trust specifically created to look at the interest of participants in the national lotteries. So I think, firstly, to sum up my past experience, how relevant it is to this position. As the chairperson of the National Lotteries Participant Trust, I've had exposure to the operations functioning of the National Lotteries Commission, because the trust is accountable to the commission for its operations, and it plays a very important role. And secondly, in my about 5 or 6 years ago, I assisted the National Lotteries Commission to reposition itself. You would remember that almost 6 to 5 years ago, the commission had numerous problems. And I was then a partner of a management consulting firm, and I was specifically asked in that capacity come and facilitate and assist the Commission with a new strategy, a new annual performance plan, and how to align this to the budget of the Commission. So I'm not a stranger. I understand the workings and the functions of the Commission. Then it was called the Board, but now it's called the Commission. And I think you will agree with me, members of the committee, for the last 5 years, the Commission has done much better than it did previously. And it is this input that I made in repositioning the Commission that has assisted. And I am convinced that should I be successful, I will lead the Commission into the next phase of repositioning. And I'll talk more about how I intend repositioning the Commission later if I'm given the opportunity.
Sure you will be, Mr. Humer. Just one thing then, you know, the main criteria, just give it to me as the top three issues.
Yes. I think the chairperson should be a leader. Should be able to direct, should be able to foster teamwork, should lead ethically, must be very ethical in his leadership. And integrity is very important as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humer, for sharing that with us. And we'll then move on to our next question. I think we're looking at the Honourable Bill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humer. I need to ask you what do you envisage as the main functions of the National Lotteries Commission?
functions of the Lotteries Commission are summed up in three categories. The first category are the functions that relate to advising the Minister of Trade and Industry. There's five of them. The second category are those functions that relating to ensuring that specific things happen within the Commission, and there are three of them. The third category are those related to administering the institution, and there's two of them, and I'll come back to all of them. The last three are miscellaneous relating to three different things. Let me start with the ones that relate to advising the Minister. One, the Commission is expected to advise the Minister on the issuing of the license to conduct the National Lottery. Two, advise the Minister on the percentage of monies to be allocated in terms of Section 26(3). Three, advise the Minister on the efficacy of legislation pertaining to lotteries and ancillary matters. Four, advising the Minister on the establishment and implementing of a social responsibility program in respect of the National Lotteries. Five, advise the Minister on any matter relating to the National Lottery and other lotteries, as well as on any matter in respect of which the Minister may require advice from the board. That's the five that relates to the advising of the Minister. Now, those that relate to ensuring that the board do certain things are the following three. The board is expected to ensure that the National Lotteries and sports pools are conducted with all due propriety and integrity. Secondly, that the interests of every participant in the National Lottery are adequately protected. Thirdly, that the net profits of the National Lotteries are as large as possible. In other words, increasing the cake and ensuring sustainability. The third category relating to administering the institution are the following. Administer the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund, as well as holding it in trust. In other words, the board members are also trustees of the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund. Secondly, administering and investing monies that are paid to the National Lotteries Commission in accordance with the Lotteries Act. The last miscellaneous three relate to monitoring, regulating, and policing the lotteries. Secondly, performing such additional duties in respect of the lotteries as the Minister may assign to the board from time to time. And the last one is making arrangements as may be specified in the license conditions with regard to prize monies and the sums that need to be distributed to the distributing agencies. In other words, those funds have to be preserved and secured in accordance with the conditions that are specified in the license agreement. These are, in a nutshell, the main functions and mandate of the board of the National Lotteries Commission.
One of the functions of the Commission is to advise the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation. In your opinion, what are some of the challenges in the implementation of the legislation? Are there any areas or issues that you maintain should be brought to the immediate attention of the Minister?
Thank you for the question. Advising the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation would involve, in my opinion, analysing the shortcomings of the current legislation and I have observed the following shortcomings. Firstly, there's illegal lotteries in the market space. Secondly, bookmakers are not regulated at this point in time. Society lotteries and other lotteries, online lotteries, are not regulated as well. There is also online playing, online lotteries, which are not adequately regulated. And I think the legislation needs to be reviewed to accommodate the regulating of bookmakers, society lotteries, the clamping down on illegal lotteries because of the loss of revenue from that side, and also on the other lotteries that I've mentioned earlier. But more importantly, also in terms of the rules that needs to be promulgated to ensure that the changes are effective, it's really aligning the grant-making processes with the objectives of the Act, and also ensuring that there are mechanisms put in place to ensure timely grant-making or distribution of the funds. At the moment, the period is adequate, but if it can be changed to make the turnaround better. If you look at the financial year and the period that is allocated, it means almost 4 to 5 months elapses before you could distribute the funds. I think these are the key observations that I've made for myself.
If you would put your mic off at the moment, Mr. Humer. We then go on to the Honourable Kalago's question.
When advising the Minister on the allocations of the various categories of good causes, what factors will you take into consideration?
I think it's important to take into account the following factors. One, the revenue derived from each province is very critical. For instance, if one province accounts for a particular percentage of the revenue, that needs to be taken into account, firstly. Secondly, the state of the economy in that particular province is very important. There are certain areas of our country that are very depressed economically, where there's poverty, there's unemployment, and so forth. The third criteria should be the percentage of the population that needs the kind of support that the NLC provides. And the one that comes to my mind, which is not really provided for in the Act, is really focusing more and more on the rural and the poor in the villages, simply because they cannot put the applications successfully because of the illiteracy levels, the lack of infrastructure, and the knowledge of how the institution works. So that will assist in alleviating poverty and deprivation in the rural communities. I mean, if you look at most of the grants that have been allocated to date, even though more may be in the so-called rural provinces, but they go still in the towns and cities of those rural provinces. Those allocations do not go to where they are needed most, which is the villages. So something needs to be done by redirecting the funds to But also when we give it to the villages, we should look at the concept of social entrepreneurship. We do not become another SASSA, just grant making. We need to look at social entrepreneurship, funds or allocations that will empower the community to create sustainable livelihoods for themselves. I've seen this concept recently when I visited Botswana. The government of Botswana is giving more money to communities in rural villages to sustain themselves so that they become less and less dependent on the state. It's called social entrepreneurship. And this and the other part that I think is very important is cooperation and partnership between the NLC and other funders. For instance, I have also observed double dipping in the system. So if the NLC partners with other government grant-making institutions to focus more on social entrepreneurship, we could go a long way to alleviating poverty in the country.
Thank you very much. We then move on to a question from the Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Mr. Yuma. Or I should rather say, goeiemôre. Want ek sien, jy is, jy kan jy self excellent uitdruk in baie tale. So, my question to you is, if governance challenges were to arise between the National Lotteries Commission and the distributing agencies, how would you address these challenges? Thank you.
I think one of the cardinal principles of corporate governance is that the board should be able to manage stakeholders. You have different stakeholders in this institution. And one of the immediate and key stakeholders is the distributing agency. Provision has been made in terms of the Lotteries Amendment Act that the distributing agencies should have full-time members who are now employees of the Commission and they are occupying space within the premises. So I would create a subcommittee of the board, which I would want the chair of the board to be in charge of, to ensure that on a quarterly basis, the board and the distributing agencies have regular meetings to be able to discuss areas of concern or areas of dissatisfaction so that they are resolved timely. And I would ensure that there's a proper board committee charter which defines the roles and responsibilities of this committee. And I would invite the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the distributing agencies and all the members of the board to participate in that board committee.
You have a follow-up, Honourable Van Schalkwyk. Thank you, Mr. Huma. We have the Honourable now McPherson, and we're moving into the, you know, trying to get an understanding from you, what you think of leadership, your understanding of leadership, Honourable McPherson.
Mr. Huma, what experience do you currently have in terms of board memberships or senior level management?
I have vast experience, and I'll try and go back and trace my experience to when I first started working. I have been a manager at a number of organizations, promoted to senior management, and became an executive. As I previously alluded, I was a partner is a leader in an institution at a global level, and currently I chair the BDH Trust. I'm the CEO of the BDH Group, which is a holding company with about 7 subsidiaries. I'm on the board of the Lanseria Airport. I'm on the board of the NLC. I'm the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee of the Office of the Chief Justice. I chair the Audit and Risk Committee of the National Department of Health. I also chair the Audit and Risk Committee of the Department of Public Service and Administration. And I think among the few that I've mentioned will demonstrate my leadership. And I've served in those institutions as chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committees, as chairpersons of boards, as chairpersons of trust. And this has not just come overnight. It's because I've got a very long, illustrious career, starting as a law lecturer at the University of the North and West University, moving into the private sector, KUC, Group 5, and many others, moving into executive management and ending up in boards and trust as an ordinary board member or trustee, and also now as chairperson of a number of those institutions. And I've been adequately trained. I'm not just in those positions by growth or time. I have attended numerous training that prepared me significantly for a leadership position. One kind of a training is the leadership I got at Henley Management School in the UK about corporate governance. It includes governance, compliance, risk management, financial management, strategic management, and Accenture had its own university in Chicago and at Oxford. It owns 25% of Oxford University, and its partners were compelled to regularly go for training at Oxford and at St. Charles in Chicago. So they made sure that by the time you become partner, you're fully trained and you can appreciate your leadership position and you can make a proper, meaningful contribution. So I have risen through the ranks, progressing to where I am, but that was underpinned by proper training and leadership, being prepared to take a proper role.
Do you have another question, Honourable? I just wanted you very briefly to give me the number of boards you're sitting on.
The first one is the NS, or the number. About four. I am excluding Audit and Risk Committees.
Yeah, I think those are important. They take a lot of time. So it's five altogether. Yes, five boards. I thought as much. Thank you. I have to take the Honourable Hildius, then I'm going to take the Honourable Kalaka.
Thank you, sir. You obviously have vast experience. I want to check, what does the BDH group do? Is it the chemicals group?
No, it's not in the chemical. It's got investment in the pharmaceutical industry. It's in property, and it's in financial management.
And I presume you would be prepared to resign as the Chief Executive Officer were you appointed?
My time is up already. I'm being pushed out.
Oh dear.
In fact, at the end of no, not really, because you need to give the young people more creative. At the end of June, at the shareholders meeting, the successor has already been appointed. I'll be stepping down.
Thank you.
And I it's willingly. I appreciate it because now the young people need to be given chance and space.
Let me just come to the Honourable Kalaka, please.
No, Chair, for me it's a similar question. Due to the fact that you are in many boards and chairing many boards, will you have time to vote your time in? If you are appointed, will you be able, with all these responsibilities in other boards, to devote your time?
I thank you very much for the question, and I think I had omitted to explain that a lot of these positions are coming to an end. There are 3-year term appointments. The office, the National Department of Health, my term is up. The DPSA, my term is up. And many of the other private sector ones are also up. I would not have made myself available for a further board position if I knew I don't have the time. I take my responsibilities extremely serious, and I would want to make a contribution, just not add numbers behind my name. also the ordinary committees meet once a quarter. And the responsibilities are really to look at the annual financial statements and the annual performance reports or the quarterly performance reports. And those are prepared by management, overseen by the minister. By the time they come to us, really, it's spending about 3 hours in a day. That's not much. They're not demanding. No, not at all. They're not like the boards. The boards are more demanding. The Audit and Risk Committee is more of an oversight committee looking at risk and financial management.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humer. We have the Honourable Van Skalkwyk again.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mr. Humer, how do you understand the difference between the roles of the Commissioner and the Board, and what is the relationship between the Board, the Minister and Parliament? Thank you.
That's a good one. Because all these people have to work together to make the institution more successful. There's a lot of interdependencies. The Commissioner is an executive functionary of the Commission. He or she is responsible for the full administrative, executive, and other functions of the Commission. And he or she accounts for the full functions of the Commission to the Board of the NLC. And he gets directions and guidance from the Board to implement its strategy and the APP, or Annual Performance Plan, as well as the budget. Now, in turn, the Board provides leadership, guidance, and directs the activities of the Commission, and ensuring that the medium-term strategic framework is realized and achieved through the strategic plan and the APP, and also reports to the executive authority. The Board is the accounting authority, and the Minister is the executive authority. He or she is in charge of that institution. The buck stops with the minister politically. So you have to account to the minister as the Board. But also very important, the Board, the minister is held accountable by Parliament through its portfolio committee for the functioning of the institution. And therefore, the Board will assist the minister in ensuring that the institution is governed correctly and accounts for its finances and performance to the committee, this committee. So I would expect that on a quarterly basis, the NLC is invited to the committee, the portfolio committee, to account for its performance, obviously with the CEO or CEO, to ensure that the annual performance plan responsibilities are executed and full accountability is given to this committee. So there's a very good relationship. I think the governance model is very straightforward. You know, everybody accounts to somebody. And there's a structured mechanism of accounting, because the commissioner has a strategic plan, it's got the APP, and it's got the budget. He or she needs to account to the board in respect of all of those. The board must account to the minister. The minister must account in respect of the three to Parliament. Also, the Commission accounts directly to Parliament whenever they are required to come to Parliament and account. So all four needs to work together to ensure a well-functioning, accountable institution.
Thank you. Do you want to follow up? I think, Do you want to follow up on this question? Right. We then move on to the Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Humer. Briefly, sir, what would you identify as your 5-year strategic objectives or priorities for the Commission, were you to be appointed the Chairman? And secondly, what systems or processes would you implement to monitor the progress made in achieving those strategic objectives?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Let me, before I outline my key strategy, challenges that I have observed to date, and therefore they will link very well with why I have these strategic objectives in mind for the next 5 years. The challenges that I've noted, and these are based on my own personal analysis of the annual report of the institution, because I've been tracking how well the institution is doing since I last facilitated their strategic plan. The first one is illegal lotteries. And in my five-year plan or strategic objectives, I would like to address the issue of illegal lotteries. The second one is fraud, and that manifests itself in the form of double dipping. In other words, you apply to the national lotteries, you apply to Arts and Culture, you apply to DTI itself, you apply to whatever other institution for the same project. The third one is misalignment of grant allocation processes. If these processes are engineered, we'll deliver faster, we'll deliver much faster. The fourth one is non-compliance with the prescribed time frames. The fifth one is information management and information security. The last one is participant protection. Participant protection in the form of unsecured online playing. Confidentiality is a big issue. And excessive playing. No one monitors excessive playing. You know, I can play the lotto every time and deplete the resources of the family, and no one is looking at that. And also underage play. No one knows if kids of 8 years, 10 years are playing. They could be playing. You give them money, pocket money for school, they save it to play the lotto. So it's another area that we need to look at. Now let me turn to my 5 years strategic objectives. And of course this I have to sell hard to my fellow board members and executive management. It's just my narrow view of what I think needs to be done. Firstly, to reposition the NLC as a regulator. At the moment, the roles of the NLC are confused. On the one hand, the NLC is the regulator. On the other, it's a grant-making institution through the distributing agencies. It focuses on the applications are processed, grants are made to the beneficiaries. So there's a dual mandate. And I really like the question that I was asked about the efficacy of the current legislation. Because the current legislation has created by default a dual mandate. And if you look at the UK model, it's slightly different from us, and a lot could be learned from the UK model. I know ours is maturing, but as we mature, we can also look at the UK model. So that repositioning is very important. As a regulator, we're not doing very well because there are illegal lotteries. We're also not regulating bookmakers, society, lotteries, and other forms of lotteries. A good example is, to what extent are we regulating online lotteries? I don't think we are regulating them adequately. Let me turn to the second area that I would like to focus on for the next 5 years if I'm successful. I would gradually like to focus the NLC towards social entrepreneurship. And I spoke about social entrepreneurship earlier. And in this regard, I would like to see increased social impact as well as high visibility of our projects, which has to leave a lasting legacy. But more importantly, to achieve social entrepreneurship, we will have to partner with other government institutions. Institutions which are making, which are facilitating grant making. Thirdly, I would, as I said earlier, would like to focus on rural areas. I'm not meaning by any way to say that urban centers would not receive any assistance, but I would like to focus in rural areas, particularly the village people who have no other means of attaining funds. And I think they are at a disadvantage because of the levels of education, poor technology infrastructure, accessibility to infrastructure, and so forth. And this will assist LLC to have a better footprint. And then the fourth one is to explore further measures to make the NLC sustainable and grow its revenue. And by implication, it touches on the first one, because if you want to maximize your revenue, you've got to fulfill your responsibility of regulation. Society lotteries are not regulated, bookmakers are not regulated, online playing is not fully regulated. So by regulating all of this, it increases your revenue, because they are all regulated and they have to pay something into your coffers. And the fifth one is developing strategies in preparation for the next licensing process. My own observations as I was reading the papers, I got the impression that we start very late in preparation for the next license. So you need to work on it and appreciate the risks around the preparations for this license. And then the last one is increasing focus on enforcement. As it stands now, the National Lotteries Commission does not have enforcement powers. And this will be part of advising the minister in reviewing the legislation. Enforcement powers, regulation without enforcement cannot be successful. If you look at the Financial Services Board and many others, it has enforcement powers. They can investigate, impose penalties on the financial institutions they are regulating. But the NLC is regulating without enforcement powers. These are the six key focus areas that I would like to translate into strategic objectives for the next 5 years. The rest of the organization is functioning very well. I mean, if you look at the clean audit, I've gone through the financial statements, I've looked at the annual report, AG report, it seems everything is going fine. There are just these minor little areas that needs to be attended to.
Sure. All right. Thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up? Right. We then move on to the Honourable McPherson.
Mr. Hume, how would you ensure that realistic targets for the commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
Repeat the latter part.
How would you ensure that realistic targets for the commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
I think the start with compiling a performance agreement of the commission is first analyzing the 5-year strategic plan and the 1-year operational plan. Now, bear in mind the annual operational plan is a tool for implementing the strategic plan on an annual incremental basis. So I would take the annual performance plan, KPIs and targets, and cascade them into the commissioner's performance agreements. In other words, those KPIs and targets that are in the APP have to be exactly the same in the commissioner's performance agreement. So as we measure the performance of the institution, we are primarily measuring the performance of the commissioner. And the Public Service Act and the regulations makes provision that all public servants should be evaluated in terms of their performance twice per annum. The first evaluation is a biannual evaluation, which is done and recorded, and the last one is an annual evaluation which may result in performance rewards depending whether you have performed. So primarily I would take the KPIs, the targets in the APP, put them in the commissioner's performance contracts, and on a quarterly basis when the commissioner prepares performance information, quarterly reports to the board, which ultimately ends up in this committee, there will be that sync. So that if for instance, the department records a poor performance, say of 45% for the quarter, then it immediately reflects on the commissioner. The commissioner should be getting the same, because you have cascaded. There is a thing, there's a link between the organizational KPIs and targets with those of the individual commissioner. So on a quarterly basis, we monitor them. On a biannual basis, the Public Service Act performance evaluation mechanisms kick in, and on an annual basis, after the annual performance report has been prepared and the Auditor General has audited the annual performance report, then we assess the commission. What is said about the performance of the organization will be said about the performance of the commission. And the commissioner also has to cascade his or her KPIs and targets into the executives so that everybody else works towards the common goal. There will be a KPI on finance, on operations, on grant making, on everything else. And those get cascaded to the lower levels so that we focus on common goals and objectives.
Thank you very much. Do you want to follow up, Honourable McPherson? Honourable Kalako.
Thank you, Chair. How would you ensure that the discretionary fund is utilized in a balanced manner to promote community, that is community development, and be utilized in a sustainable manner?
Well, I think it's important to create a framework, a policy framework around any discretionary fund to ensure that as you disperse funds in terms of a discretionary fund, there is a policy framework that guides us to disperse those funds. And we should stick to those policy guidelines, and it should be audited both by internal audit and external audit to ensure that the funds are not abused or are not dispersed for unintended purposes. But also in terms of ensuring that the oversight of those funds is created properly with the adequate skills of a balanced nature to ensure that they are done correctly. But more importantly also, these are the funds that we should achieve high impact, high visibility, and must go to the poor of the poorest, so that the commission's creation and establishment can be felt in the country. So in a nutshell, it's policy framework that guides how these grants, discretionary grants, are allocated. It's oversight on the grants by a multidisciplinary team. Thirdly, it's auditing by both internal audit on a quarterly basis and on an annual basis, the Auditor General. And fourthly, is to ensure that there are clear goals for which these discretionary grants are geared or are intended to achieve, and then we should be able to function properly.
Do you have a follow-up for that, Honourable Kalako? Because I see that that's the community development area, isn't it? Am I right? Do you have a follow-up, anyone?
With your permission, I want to emphasize the fact that because they are community development funds, we have to have very clear goals of what we want to achieve. In other words, we specify what community development projects we want. commission. Those are the important criteria for me in allocating those funds to those community development projects.
Thank you, Mr. Huma. I just want to check with the Honourable Polanco, because there were two questions there, but in some ways you appear to have conflated some of our points. Do you want to just ask another question in that regard, Honourable Polanco?
One other question, which I think is related on this also, is what strategies do you think the Commission should implement in order to assess the impact of the funds dispersed, that they are utilized correctly, they are not misused, or they are not, as it often happens in other cases, that those funds are consumed in administration, paying of salaries in particular?
I think, firstly, there needs to be a monitoring and evaluation framework. Now, once you set out, there's a basic principle about a 70-30 split with government funds. So in other words, 70% of the funds must be used for operational purposes, achieving your strategy and your APP, and 30% should be able to go to personnel expenditure. So if you stick to that principle, then you know the funds that are collected are utilized for the intended purposes. Now, with the disbursements of funds and the operational expenditure, you need to ensure that the goals and the objectives that are in one, the annual performance plan are achieved by utilization of the budget. Or in the case of the distributing agencies and the discretionary funds, the applicable policies are observed as the framework shall have been developed. But importantly, there must be a monitoring and evaluation function that evaluates and monitors projects on a regularly basis and gives feedback to the organization, meaning the board, on a quarterly basis. But also, internally, the same monitoring and evaluation a unit should also be able to evaluate the performance of the organization in terms of the monies allocated to be spent within the organization. Let me give you a practical example. If you're doing spending a lot of money on ICT infrastructure to enable your processes in the organization, at some stage you may want to do a performance audit, you know, to determine whether there's value for money. Is the spend really giving you the value that you were looking for? So monitoring and evaluation would assist a great deal internally and externally, because it will check whether the intended objectives are being achieved within the set policy parameters, and internal audit will go as the third line of assurance, will also go and audit and be able to tell us if the goals are achieved. So in other words, you put in some form of what we call combined assurance or integrated assurance, which then says within the institution, management is the first line of assurance and give us those reports, which are then checked by M&E, monitoring and evaluation, risk management, to say to the board, yes, the funds are being utilized correctly, we're working within the policy parameters. But then the third line of assurance, which is more independent of management and accounts directly to the board, is your internal audit, who then goes out and give us that assurance. Bear in mind, as a board member, you can't know. You're outside. You come to a meeting. You don't even have an office there. So you rely heavily on internal audit to audit and provide independent assurance reports to the board to say, yes, policies have been followed, the budget has been utilized correctly, and we can support the view that is expressed by management. And that will be corroborated by the Auditor General at the end of the financial year or during the interim audit. So there are checks and balances, there are policy frameworks, there are procedures to ensure that monies are spent. And if these are not done, consequence management will follow, will certainly follow, because once the policy parameters are there and clear guidelines have been laid down, so everybody must work within them to achieve the goals.
Right. I do have a question myself broadly in this area. You seem to be quite familiar with the legislation in this regard. And I know more recently, a few years back, one of the clauses was amended to facilitate proactive identification. And you've given us some good, interesting ideas about how things would be done in the community to ensure they retain sustainable development or became, as you put it, social entrepreneurs and did not become dependent. But how would you see yourself, if you were leading here, trying to facilitate this proactive? It's easy to get requests for funds. We all want money. But how do you go out and go to those communities where, in fact, they don't know how to access anything? They haven't heard about it. Thank you.
The in order for the NLC to disperse these funds in a balanced, responsible way, we need to commission research first so that our funding is supported by evidence-based research. In other words, we need to really know what are the needs and challenges of the communities out there. And once those have been documented, we then need to be able to identify projects that support those needs and allocate funds correctly. Now, proactive identification can also create problems by its nature because it's not an application by a community member. It is a board identifying specific projects and deciding that they will fund those projects. And it dovetails with the issue of discretionary funds, because now the funds are within the discretion of the board, how they utilize them. In order for the board not to be accused of favoritism or acting impartially or unfairly, evidence-based research of the needs of communities will support how the board distributes these funds. Because when you are accused, you can say, look, we've conducted research across the country in these provinces, and these were identified as the key needs of the communities in all of these provinces. We profiled these provinces, and based on that profiling, we have selected the following projects, and we have a criteria that we use for selection of those projects. The criteria can be developed by the board to say, this is the criteria, we followed our criteria, we followed our policy framework, we followed our procedures, and we have allocated accordingly. So it creates that balance and takes away all these suspicions of the board. Well, you raised another important question of being approached with lots and lots of applications, everybody wanting to get a fair share of the cake. There are two processes. It will be through the distribution agencies, which is the normal process. Everything, policy framework is set. Everybody must meet that criteria, and it must be awarded. I think the more challenging one is this one, on the side of the board. But once we have a policy framework, procedures, we've got the criteria, and it's audited, it creates, takes away an element of suspicion out of it, that the board is operating above board and can be trusted. And I think research and documentation of that research and the profiling of provinces and districts or regions would be critical.
Now, I really want to thank you, Mr. Humer. I'm looking at the committee. They appear to be satisfied. Do you want to raise something, Honourable Hill Lewis?
Two brief follow-ups, if I may. Mr. Humer, thank you. Your CV shows that you are exceptionally well educated and experienced. I just want to check for my own peace of mind. Is it true that long before my time, the University of the North was referred to as Universitas Aquilonia? Was that its name?
Have their Latin equivalent names at that
okay.
time. Yeah.
All right.
But that name was not formally used.
Right. Okay.
Just through the citation, when you receive your degree, they'll do a citation of the degree in Latin and the university. It's an old tradition of
Thank
many
you.
Universities.
And then one other question, if I may, Chairperson. The issue of integrity, which you have touched on, is an important one to us, obviously. The Commission and the grant-making and the distribution agencies have control over an enormous amount of funds, and the opportunities for unethical behavior are plenty. So I wonder whether you could say a bit more about how you, if you were appointed, will assure integrity in the Commission, that funds are used for their intended purposes, that they are not used for political means, that they are not used for friends and family and connected ones of those in the Commission or in the distributing agencies themselves.
Thank you. That's a tough one. And I think ethical leadership requires the board to be above board and lead by example. And establishing governance protocols, establishing policies and procedures, engaging stakeholders, publishing your criteria for evaluation of applications, allowing internal audit and the AG to audit, accounting for the funds and the performance of the institution, to the executive authority, the portfolio committee, and publishing an annual report to the public and engaging stakeholders in various regions and towns of our country would assist in making our work more transparent so that everybody can ask the right questions if they have any suspicions. And also allowing a hotline where the public can raise issues through the hotline, and that hotline must be managed correctly through internal audit and directly to the board. So governance mechanisms do provide a measure of a sense of security or a sense that things will be done correctly. It's only organizations where their policies, their procedures, their frameworks are not published, their criteria for adjudicating applications are not published, or there's no mechanism to complain when your application is not successful. There's a review procedure that is in the Act, and when you allow internal audit, which is supposed to be independent, free access to any document, to any person, that in itself ensures, you know, public confidence and accountability. You allow the Auditor General to audit freely. You have a toll-free system of reporting suspicious or alleged misconduct or fraudulent activities. All those are meant to create public confidence in the institution, and those must be encouraged and maintained at all costs.
Now, Chair, just a question so that we reassure ourselves. It often usually happens that we interview candidates here in various committees, and if find they have not disclosed whether a person have a criminal record in the past, or whether, as you were serving in the trust, which was accountable to the National Lottery Board, whether you never had any, whether sometimes allegations which were made against you by people which you have been dealing with in the trust, and even your colleagues working with. Can you make us at least comfortable around that?
Honourable Member, in your daily activities, there will be all sorts of suspicions, allegations, mistrust. And the starting principle is any allegation must be reported to the police or must be reported to the responsible institution which will investigate. If there's a case against you, then you must answer in an open court of law. But we cannot live by mistrust, gossips, malicious talks in the corridors to say this might have happened, this might not happen. All I can tell you to date, I do not have a criminal record or a criminal conviction, and I do not intend to spoil my long, hard end career. Remember, I'm an advocate of the High Court of South Africa and my fellow of the Institute of Directors. If I'm convicted of any fraud or misconduct of any nature, I'm struck off the roll immediately, and I wouldn't want to lose my certificate. I'll be struck off the roll. It's not just about being convicted of fraud. It's about any misconduct of a gross nature makes me liable. So I'm saying to you that I have not been convicted of any criminal offense. I've not appeared before any disciplinary committee and found guilty of any misconduct of any nature. Gossips, corridor talks will always be there. You know, when people don't get what they want, when you differ, some of people will always allege what they allege. But I'm saying there's proper mechanisms to, you know, to challenge those who believe there could be something against you. I mean, I've led many organizations, and people always say, hey, we don't know what these guys are doing. And I always say, take me to task. I mean, I'm there to be challenged, I'm open. And I have more to lose than anybody else. I mean, who doesn't want to have the title of advocate and retain your certificate? Because that's my fallback. If anything doesn't work, I can go back to court. I can go to board of directors, which are more prestigious. You see? So I wouldn't want to do anything stupid.
If I may just point out to the committee, not that that excludes that question at all. We may all wish to ask it. But the process in Parliament for the appointment of boards is a security clearance, which was a two-week process. I just wanted to get the time when it actually took place. But we will get that. It took place some time ago, actually. But of course, in the interim, people may have done certain things, if I can put it that way. But having said that, I would like to thank you on behalf of the committee, Mr. Humer, for availing yourself and being here with us today. And I'm sure as you leave, you can rest assured that this committee, after today's process, will study the responses and our own notes, and then engage with each other. In short, this is not going to be just a snap decision. It is a very, very responsible position to hold. And we want to ensure that the person appointed has the integrity, the technical know-how, the commitment, and the ethical approaches and is in line with the policies of our country before we appoint. So we will consult each other and discuss this, but thank you again, and you will be informed. I'm looking at both the secretary here on my left as well as the whip. Politically, we expect to have some position to go before Parliament, which has to, of course, adopt our recommendation, and that is likely to happen in about a month, I imagine. Am I correct, Mr. Holmes? The parliamentary process. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chairperson and honourable members, let me thank you for the opportunity. It was my first ever experience being interviewed by the Parliament. It's not an easy one, but I've enjoyed it. It was tough, but it's good. I think that's what we need. We need transparency. We need to be subjected to all sorts of checks and balances, and all questions must be asked. Thank you very much.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Abel Mawela. I've been serving a number of boards. I'm also a member of the Institute of Directors, a title called Certified Director. You acquire through some rigorous process within the IDCA. My experience was twofold. Well, I spent on a number of boards, but the most important is that I'm actually serving on one of the entities that this committee is also responsible for. The entity is the Export Credit Insurance Corporation, ECIC. So I'm, in a manner of speech, a member of the family. I chair the audit committee of that board. I would venture to even argue that it's one of the best run boards, I think, of this within the DTI family. ECIC, yes, and I chair the audit committee. I'm mentioning this because lately SOEs that are well run are becoming scarcer, so I can take a flag and say I represent one of those best. So being the chairman of the audit committee, you're actually the focal point of the organization. You make sure that all due processes are followed, the SOE Act itself and other judiciary duties are carried out. In my previous life, I also chaired, which is one of the, I think, the flagship of South Africa's project. I chaired the board of the Gautrain. And I was there during the construction. And we oversaw the construction and migrated into operation. You'd recall the 2010 hub of activity where we ran up to Sandton and how we later on ran all the stations. This at the time was a greenfield project. It was having a lot of doubting Thomases. By the time I had left in 2 years' time, it was an award-winning project. Well run, clean audits. The best Africa has seen. In fact, we've been overwhelmed with visitations to come and see how we do it. And, I've served in other boards as well within the Blue IQ and so on. I just mentioned those two just to show. And even at that time, before I became the chairperson of the board, I actually chaired the audit committee. So it looks like my audit committee background helps me to have a bigger view of how to govern. As to what I can contribute, at the current ECIC program, we had an issue regarding the interest makeup. We had to resolve the problem. It was, in a manner of speech, a cutthroat decision to make. However, I do recall having to play a role in the board to try and make the board to reconsider the wisdom of trying to resolve it. So what do I bring? I bring a leadership and sense of direction. I also bring, but I just explained to you, I don't bring it in such a way that I create where board members would dissent and everything. I operate largely on a method of general consensus. I do not want to leave behind an unhappy board member who wants to dissent, and I'm not sure. I have to listen to them until I'm sure that we understand where we differ. And if I have persuasion to make, I implore my ability to persuade. But if it's a dissent, let's go back and redraw and come with the figures again and deliver it further. So it's not like now that I don't agree with you and I can see a few people are happy with me, let's raise hands. That's what I bring. It's a team player. It's leadership. It's also courage to break the ice.
I was hoping you would also add to that. Give us just three main criteria, the three key criteria that you identify as being appropriate for the chairperson.
The chairperson, critically, and this comes strongly through the King 4, sets the ethical tone of the organization. The chairperson provides leadership. In this case, you'd recall that the board is the accounting authority. It reports to the executive authority, being the department, the shareholder. And you therefore become the conduit between the operations as led by the commissioner and the shareholder. So it is very important that at that level you are able to understand the stakeholder implications of all players. And you lead, what's critical, you need to lead with moral authority. It helps you to be clear, it helps you to be consistent, and to be good at what you're doing.
Thank you very much there, Mr. Mawela. And we can then move on to another question coming from the Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to meet you. My question is, what do you envisage as the main functions of the National Lotteries Commission?
The National Lotteries Commission is a regulator. And by a regulator, it sets the standards, the rules, and then ensures implementation. And if there is deviations, it sanctions out undue behavior. So it derives its authority from a number of pieces of legislation. The actual NLC Act as amended, and the Companies Act, the PFMA, even the Code of the King. So from the Lotteries Act as amended, it ensures that the National Lottery and the sports pools are conducted properly in terms of the act. It protects the interest of all the role players in the industry.
it advises the minister on matters pertaining to the lottery. It does research to ensure that there may be good causes that have not been hitherto applied for, but that research enables it to say, but this is a good cause. For example, early childhood development. It also manages the operations of the NLC entity on its own. However, from time to time, the minister might request the commission to carry out one duty or another. It also carries that out. So it's, in a manner of speech, it's a quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative, and quasi-executive. What it does, it becomes your first line of defense on all role players. If you are a activity role person in the lotteries industry, you are not safe about anything else. Your first line of call is with the NLC.
Thank you very much. Do you want to follow up there on one person? No. Let's move on then and take our next question. Thank you. Sorry, my apologies, delaying everyone here.
One of the functions of the Commission is to advise the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation. In your opinion, what are some of the challenges in the implementation of the legislation? Are there any areas or issues that you maintain should be brought to the immediate attention of the Minister?
Well, I would say the issue of the distribution agencies, their appointment, who appoints them and who do they report to. Unless you address that one, you are likely to end up with unnecessary conflicts. You did not appoint me, I cannot. But you see, if you follow the board is the accounting authority. In other words, whatever the distribution agents do or do not do, whether they do properly or not, ultimately the accounting authority must account. So that area I think has got to be clarified. I tend to err on the side of saying the board must have the final say on it. Well, the other one is on enforcement, really, to say if you go out there, you observe an illegal activity in, say, in the industry, someone is running an illegal, can you effect an arrest? Do you have the powers to arrest or to enforce the law? If you don't have it, you then depend on another area of another department within government. You may or may not achieve effectively because it's out of your ambit of control. I think the other one is, who do you really distribute money to? Would you give it to political parties, state of organ? I think these are areas that remain a moot point. I don't know which one is right or wrong, but I would be wary to sponsor a political party or a person with significant political views. You then tend to enter into politics, and I don't think that's what the NLC should go into.
I'm just wanting to make sure that you understood the question. Was that coming from yourself, Honourable Macpherson, number two? was looking at one of the functions of the commission is to advise the minister, and you were coming on to it quite well on the efficacy of the current legislation. The efficacy of the current, in your opinion, what are some of the challenges in the implementation of the legislation?
Okay.
And I think you were spelling that out earlier. And then secondly, are there any areas, issues that you believe, maintain, should be brought to the immediate attention of the minister? Immediately, certainly.
Okay. So
if
the
you would just perhaps...
enforcement powers.
You mentioned that.
The interpretation of some clauses pertaining to political affiliation or pertaining to state of organ, the other part was the cooling off period, 24 months. Those are the areas that I think I could bring immediately to the attention of the minister. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Mawela. We then have the Honourable Kalako. Your question.
Thank you, Chair. When advising the minister on the allocations for the various categories of good causes, what factors will you take into consideration?
Okay.
I'll repeat it, yeah? When advising the minister on the allocations for the various categories of good causes, what factors will you take into consideration?
Well, I think you should look at the effects or the benefits it will accrue to the role players, the beneficiaries. You should also understand, you know, its impact in the community in which it serves. But as an accountant, that also say it must be a viable project. It must be feasible. It must not fly in the sky. It must be something that you can, with accountants call it bankable. It must be a bankable project.
What aspects would you consider? You just mentioned bankable, and viable.
Yeah. Well, let me draw my hue from, ultimately, if I were a member of the portfolio committee, I would say, what does it achieve and how do you perform towards it? So I would look at performance percentage. But in terms of the viability, I would look at the return on investment. How do you quantify it? Is it number of jobs, et cetera, et cetera?
We're dealing with the technical aspects in this group.
Okay. If that were to happen, I would one escalated to the shareholder. But maybe before you go there, I might want to. I think ultimately, for you to ensure that the distribution agents do their work, set up a mechanism of recall, service level agreement of some sort that speaks to expectations by both parties, sets out the terms of reference. And once you have signed that accord, you then let that accord govern your relationship. If that fails, I think it should embed in it a distribution resolution mechanism. Obviously, with the ability to escalate it to the shareholder. So I think if you have built it, it becomes a good governance document to regulate your behaviors. But, however, and I would say my bit, the accounting authority is the board. So I'm biased towards the bug stopping with the board. But obviously, you cannot do that without compromising the right of the DA to defend their decisions. So I'm biased towards the board in the final say. But still, that SLA, I think, should go a long way into regulating your relationships.
Honourable Mawela, Mr. Mawela. Can we then move on to leadership? These are the leadership issues now, broader than the technical. So we're going to ask the Honourable MacPherson to come in here.
Thank you. Mr. Mawela, what experience do you currently have in terms of board memberships or senior level management?
Senior level management, I started in public sector. Before then, I used to be a management accountant at one of the entities of DNL. It was called Electro. So I would look at the costs, pricing of projects. But then I became a deputy director of revenue at the then Kempton Park Tembisa MLC. And I was on the revenue collection aspect of it. Later, when Ekuruleni came to being, I became the CFO of Ekuruleni. When we amalgamated 11 administration entities, 9 towns in the East Rand, Kempton Park, the Vale, you know them. Then there was a process called the EDI process, Electricity Distribution Industry. I think at the time the idea was to create regional electricity distributors, which failed. I think role players could not agree to it. So that's my role at the senior level financial management sphere. At board, I said earlier, I'm at the CCIC, I was at the Gautrain, I was at a number of entities within the Blue IQ. I have this fortune of always either being in the audit committee or chairing the audit committee. That seems to be a constant on my side. And I've played those roles.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up on that question, anyone? Yes, thank you, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Mawela. If you look at your CV, you know, sometimes when you're interviewing people, you don't understand the exact exact specifics and circumstances of their previous jobs. And it's sometimes a concern to see that someone goes through a number of senior positions in a relatively short time.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can just expand on, for example, you were a senior financial manager at Ekurhuleni for 18 months, then at one of the Reds for a further 18 months. What was the cause of a relatively quick turnover in senior positions?
I think it was the demands of the moment. A lot of things were happening in terms of writing new legislature, moving in, and if the industry views you as being of value, you find yourself in demand. So you know, if it were to give you the legislation landscape of the moment, 1995 we had the Local Government Transitional Act. It was a transitional act. We had to write what is called the Structures Act. After the Structures Act, we started with the MFMA, then municipal property rates and so on. So it was a fast moving change. Organizations were also changing. Reconfiguration of organizations. Then what happened was, at the EDI, it was like, when we do the EDI, we are going to need people from ESCOM and from local government at senior level who understand the viability of a municipality. You had to understand, me coming from revenue side, I understood the value of electricity revenue, making profits, and also subsidizing other services within local government. I was instrumental in the writing of the Municipal Systems Act to ensure that you use electricity cutoff to enforce payment of in other services. This was at the heart of the argument of the setting up of the regional electricity distributors. The industry needed to have people like myself who they knew, understood their plight. And so you came with that kind of credibility. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mawela. We then come to a question from the Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
How do you understand the difference between the roles of the commissioner and the board? What is the relationship between the board, the minister, and parliament according to you now? Thank you.
Sure, that one was a bit too sided. It's two questions, isn't it? The first one is...
Perhaps the Honourable Van Schalkwyk will just indicate those gaps there.
The first part is, how do you understand the difference between the roles of the commissioner and the board? That's the first part. And then the last part, what is the relationship, according to you, between the board, the minister, and parliament? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. The first part, the commissioner is the accounting officer. The commissioner is responsible for the operations of the day-to-day running of the organization. The board is the accounting authority. They've got oversight over the workings of the commissioner. The board largely consists of non-executive directors. In other words, they are non-executive, they are not reporting every day. They oversee the reports. The relationship between the board, the minister, and Parliament. The board is the accounting office. They ensure that the strategies are in place. They ensure that there's proper management of the operations of the organization. They carry out all those duties as stated in the Act. The minister is the executive authority. They are the shareholder. They are the ones that looks at the return on investment on the organizations. They are the ones that get the quarterly reports from the board. They are the ones that ensures that the annual financial statements are prepared in time, that the annual report is prepared in time. Parliament plays the role of being the regulator and the policymaker. So at Parliament, you've got the dual role. There's a role you have of SCOPA. SCOPA looks at what the Auditor General has said about the annual report. And they zoom into what the Auditor General is raising. The Portfolio Committee looks at the performance to make sure that there was service delivery of by that entity concerned. So all these role players, they create an accountability cycle.
Yes, thank you. No. Just wasn't too sure because the light is still on, you see. Right. Any follow-ups there, Honourable Van Schalkwyk? And then we move then to the next question from the Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, sir. Briefly, what would you identify as your five-year strategic objectives or priorities for the Commission if you were appointed? What system would you implement to monitor the progress in achieving your strategic objectives?
The question repeated, sorry. Yes, if you break it up a bit, thanks.
What would you identify as your five-year strategic objectives for the Commission if you were appointed as the chair? And what systems or processes would you implement to monitor implementation and achievement of those strategic objectives?
I can repeat the second one again when you finish the first response.
Thank
all right?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. The Commission has just amended its Act. And setting up of the distribution agencies, the aspect of communicating, inform and educate. So all those aspects that now come with the amendment of the Act, I think it will be imperative to make sure that they're carried out fully. Very pedantic, but it remains a strategic objective to me. Is keep the clean audit going and keep good governance going. It's also a strategic objective. Maximize your revenue and ensure that on the distribution side, you distribute correctly for the right causes. And I think largely adhere to those requirements of the Act, making sure that the National Lottery and the sports pools are carried out, you know, properly. Due propriety exists, protect the interest of the role players in the industry, advise the minister on matters pertaining to the industry and all those good causes, but also ensure that the ethical standards are adhered to as well. And then on the systems and processes, reporting, and time years, quarterly reports. Make sure that your performance reports are evaluated. Actual visas, target, deviances have been adhered to and accounted for correctly. So if you create a mechanism of reporting and ensure that the reports are correct, set up internal control measures to make sure that the three combined assurance models, the lower level being the management, is in place, internal audit is in place, external audit is in place, etc.
I just want to ask a follow-up, if I may. Thank you very much, Mr. Mawela. But I was also just trying to get a better understanding when you spoke about the monitoring, the tracking. Are you talking about generally or the targets identified that were expected?
Yes.
You know, perhaps you could just spell that out a little clearer, because I know this would, according to your CV, is an area you're familiar with.
You set a five-year strategy and you break it down into an MTF of 3 years, and then it also lands up with annual performance targets. Those performance targets, they set goals and outcomes for the year, and then you make sure that you, for every year, you can break them into quarters. And every quarter, you check actual visas performance, and you find out what are the deviations. You zoom into that, you correct it. Yeah. And even up to, until at the year end, you write an annual report that should speak to the annual financial performances, to the performance, sustainability, and that those are the reports you send to the shareholder, who will in turn send it to Parliament for accountability, etc. Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mawela. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Mawela. How would you ensure that realistic targets for the Commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately? How would you ensure that realistic targets for the Commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
What they call it, SMART. You SMART your goals. There must be, targets must be set, they must be measurable, they must be attainable, they must be time-bound and quantifiable. Then, once they've got all those SMART criteria, they lend themselves to be easy to adjudicate as to whether they were attained or not. For example, if you were to say, your objective is to create compliance, you've got to say how, who do you comply to, the number of instances, and over the periods, so that you're able to measure and attain it. So your performance must be SMART.
Thank you, Honorable. Mr. Mawela. Any follow-up?
I like Honorable Chair.
Well, it's not my function, actually, to begin to enter that arena. But thank you, yes. Honourable MacPherson, did you want to follow up? I just was caught off guard there. Did you want to follow up? No. Right. Thank you very much. So we then move on to the the community development. We've covered the general, the technical, the leadership area, and now we're on community development. And that we're going to return to the Honourable Kalako to be addressing those issues.
Thank you, Chair. How would you ensure that the discretionary funds is utilized in a balanced manner to promote community development and be utilized in a sustainable manner? I think discretionary funds, for starters, we should take them as funds. It's not that they are discretionary, they can be used, you know, willy-nilly. One of the things you put mechanisms of control to it, and you also set standards which they need to achieve. But you need to make sure that your projects are sustainable, they are viable as well. In other words, move away from thinking that because it's discretionary, it's wasteable. It's not wasteable. It must also follow the due process of thorough usage. That's all.
Do you want a follow-up question, Honourable Kalata? The discretionary funds issue, if I may just check here. One's looking at perhaps the aspects today, it's not just giving people money, but it specifically emphasises to be utilised in a sustainable manner. If you had that discretion and you are identifying people, how would you ascertain that? There again, where how would you ensure that the discretionary fund, that was the question, is utilised in a balanced manner to promote community development, but also be utilised in a sustainable manner? How would that be measured? How would you look
at it? Well, Chair, I'll set proper reporting and control mechanisms. I would also ensure that there are right committees in place to even assist the community to make sure that they achieve their goals.
Next question, Honourable Kalako.
What strategies should the Commission implement in order to assess the impact of the funds dispersed? What strategies should the Commission implement in order to assess the impact of the funds?
Thank you.
like it expressed again?
No, no, it's just difficult. I must not think of it. I think it's clear. Yeah, no, sure.
Yes.
Let me do that.
It can be quite an ordeal sometimes.
Yeah. In class, when such questions come, you let the lecturer pass, but on this one, it's facing. I wish I had a classmate. Well, to assess the impact of the strategy to implement in order to assess the impact of the fund, in other words, you're giving funds and you want to know do they really impact out there. I think for starters, you need to set out your own targets up front. You need to know what you want to achieve. And when you do monitoring and follow-ups, it's also important to go out there in the community yourself and make an independent assessment is the impact really happening at the desired outcome. Often they do, but if they don't, it's never too late to review them. Sometimes objectives and the impact could be over-exaggerated, but you may want to say, okay, maybe I was aiming too high, let me be, you know, reasonable. So you keep your eye on the ground, make sure that you understand the impact and where possible, increase or decrease them based on the circumstances. Normally, you would need a third party to help you with that because they come with a fresh way of looking at things, an independent way. They can also help you to sharpen the pen either ways. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Mawela. Do you have a follow-up at all? Right. Mr. Mawela, perhaps looking at some of the broader issues here, you know, I looked at this, you, as I said earlier on, you had a fair amount of experience, and you yourself confirmed this, going into new positions, as it were, or new areas. I think that would be a better way of putting it, in response to new legislation and that kind of thing. And then also your experience on audit, etc. committees. I still would like to get a better understanding myself on how do you believe that experience, and you've had a variety in that regard in these new projects or new issues or new legislation and regulation and policy, how do you think that will assist you to carry out the functions of a chairperson, this chairpersonship?
Being a member of the ACIC, I'm in the family. So it may not sound critical, but it is, in that I have interacted with the shareholder, the owner. It is also important sometimes to understand the culture in the family. So by having been with the ECIC for quite a lot, I understand how the DTI operates. So it's important at that level, because you're not new. You almost tend to able to direct the organization to say at ECIC, at the shareholder level, these are the tolerance levels, you know. Well, not specific to this minister, but any minister does not want to wake up on a Sunday morning in front of a newspaper. So those are the things that you can immediately build into an organization to say, guys, this is serious. Let's try to work correctly. And that is important. ethical leadership and moral leadership is paramount. Compliance is paramount. So I think that one can bring in. I understand how the department works. But besides, I think over the years, I've also come to understand, and I'm also afraid with what is happening out there in the world. You know, for example, one argues that even though there's no taxpayers' money that contributes to your organization, like we have at ECIC, it does not mean you can do what you like with the money. It is still public funds. So even at ECIC, we move from that departure. We create our own revenue. There's no money coming from the taxpayers to ECIC. But it's not our money either. We still are responsible to the public. And so you are aware of what is happening outside. So you want to ensure that those tenets of accountability do not fall off. NLC will have a similar thing that, you know, it creates its own revenue, but it does not mean you can do what you like with that money. That tonality and leadership, I think, is what you bring to the organization, and to make sure that, you know, you stay on course and you don't drop the ball because you think you're creating the money yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Must thank you very much. Sorry, Honourable Paul Lewis, just as well, Mr. Herman.
Just one question on your CV, Mr. Mawela. I recall that the current chairperson and CEO of the license holder, Etuba, also were once upon a time members of the Board of Sheriffs, and I noticed that you also were a member of the Board of Sheriffs. In fact, I think the CEO of the license holder was the chairperson of that board. So I just want to check, is that a coincidence, or is there any informal or formal or business relationship between you and the current license holders and the leadership of Etuba?
Nah, I don't have any business relationship with that. Nah, not at all. It's interesting that you're raising it, because also the Board for Sheriff is a regulator. And it also played around the same lines. We raised revenue from the sheriffs, and we also regulated the industry and so on. So it's a similar regulation environment. Yeah.
Well, I better be careful this time and look towards my left. Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you. Mr. Mawela, thank you very much for availing yourself, making yourself available for nomination, but also coming here before us today and sharing with us this experience. And just so that you're aware of how these things work, we won't be taking a snap decision on the matter. We will be digesting this, discussing it with our parties, etc., and then with each other as a committee before we put our recommendation to Parliament itself, the House, and then, of course, a decision will be taken in the House itself, and this will be communicated to all candidates. And we expect that this process will take a month, but it could be sooner or a little longer. Thank you very much for coming here. Thank you. And we've got a couple of minutes before we get started at 22 on my watch. It's 25 to now. Impartial about the questioning, notwithstanding that Professor Alfred Nebutunde is the incumbent at the moment. Professor, you're familiar with the process, having undergone this before. We're going to be asking you a few questions, etc., and respond as adequately as you can. If you need a question repeated, please ask. Now, I think we're all here, are we not? Yes. So, you're very welcome, Professor, and it seems superfluous, but nevertheless, in the interests of objectivity briefly tell us about your past experience and relate it to the contribution you would make to the Commission? And then, in your opinion, what would be the critical criteria for the Commission chairperson? Over to yourself, Professor.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. To start with my journey up to Cape Town here. I grew up in the village. I attended school very late, but what I learned was that hard work to pace. My highest degree reached the examination orientated was a doctorate in education. Because I loved the arts, I studied music up to PhD level with the University of Pretoria. I've been a lecturer at Makado College of Education, and I've been a lecturer at the University of Venda and part-time lecturer at University of South Africa. I joined the legislature of the Limpopo government in 1999. I served one term as the leading member in the Arts and Culture Portfolio Committee and also on transport. I then quitted legislature and deployed in regulating the transport industry in the Limpopo Department of Roads and Transport. Having developed the skills of negotiating, I was then recruited to join the National Department of Transport under the then Minister Jeff Radebe, which I served as the chairperson of 9 provincial chairpersons. I'm proud of leaving the legacy of taxi recap and even modernizing the taxi industry, which was at war. I believe they're still at war, but at least we managed to regularize the taxi industry. I have been an executive member of a private company called Coal of Africa, which is a mining company. Thereafter, I was appointed at the NLC, which was then NLB, as a member of Arts and Culture Distributing Agency. There, I learned to understand how to make grants. There, I understood that it was the beginning of the National Lottery. The funding model was a bit awkward, but anyhow, we tried as the Arts Distributing Agency to make it well coordinated. I then joined the NLC board in 2009, December, as the chairperson. One of the things that I said in this house was I want to change the NLC from where it is to an NLC that is acceptable to the community, the NLC that complies with the department directives, the NLC that observes that this parliament, and if they are called upon by the portfolio committee,
they must come and report. My journey, as I conclude, was to make NLC one of the entity in the DGI that the minister and parliament can be proud of. In my journey, we made it possible that last year we ended up getting a clean audit because I understood the roles of the chairperson and the roles of the commissioner. The NLC that I found was the NLC without a structure. You come to the NLC today, there is a complete structure with executives, and the chairperson is only there to chair the meetings if the meetings are held quarterly. But I must confess, it has been a tough journey. I remember having allowed myself to change the organization physically in 2010, we were able to distribute more than 3 billion. We built the artificial turfs all over the country. That was my initiative. And currently, we have built more than 200 ECD centers, something that which all along NLC board members, the previous board, never thought that you could proactively and with the help of the department think beyond your capacity. What I regard as the criteria for a chairperson must be a citizen of South Africa. A chairperson must not have been disqualified by any court of law, whether criminally or whatever. The chairperson must have a good standing within the community. The chairperson must be respected because you are going to be the face of the organization. You are going to answer questions from media. But you must have knowledge of how the board operates, how the board functions. You must have the ability to debate, and your word must not only be the final word. You must listen to how others come up with suggestions. If it comes to voting, I would prefer that the chairperson must be very compliant with the law. It's not only the chairperson that must broker peace or be regarded as the person who favored that particular ideology. You must be a person who understands governance, corporate governance, in terms of King reports and the Companies Act. You must be the person that has knowledge to appoint senior staff members, e.g. commissioner and the executives. And you must not be biased towards somebody whom you like or whom you don't like. You must be a person who follows Batupili principles. You must judge according to what the legislation is all about. And of course, you must be able to work with big budgets. When I took over as the chairperson of the NLC, the budget was more than 6 billion. Just because the previous board didn't know that, work enough to make sure that 6 billion, we don't have to have so much money in the account. You have to give it to the public.
Thank you very much, Professor. We now move on to the technical aspects. Questions around there. Honorable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. Would you tell us what do you envisage as the main functions of the National Lotteries Commission?
Thank you, Honorable Hugh Lewis. I think let me also drop this to the legislators. with the previous act and the current act, there is a bit, a small confusion between the functions of the board and the functions of the commission. The functions of the commission, administratively, they have to make sure that the interests of every participant of the National Lottery are adequately protected. The commission must ensure that the National Lottery and the sport pools are regulated in a manner or conducted in a manner that cannot mislead the public. The National Commission must publicly educate the public how the applications are received, the processes. The public must know. But when you come to the board, the functions of the board, you have to advise the minister on the issuing of the National Lottery license and how it has to be conducted. You must also make sure that the NLDTF is kept in trust. You cannot just, you know, mess up the NLDTF, because these are the monies that are coming from the operator, and you must have the ability to invest that money so that you can give it to the public. You must also advise the minister on the efficacy of the legislation. For example, the new legislation that all members is aware of. There are other issues that you need to say, minister, we are practicing this legislation, but these are the problems that we find. You must also advise the minister on the percentages that must be allocated to different sectors. For example, if you talk of charity, it's 48%. It was 45. Sport and recreation is 27 now, which was 23. The arts, culture, national heritage, and whatsoever, it is now gone down to 23. The miscellaneous used to enjoy 5%, but now it is 2%, simply because it is the fund that must be used proactively. You cannot just splash that fund.
Thank you very much, Professor. Do you have a follow-up on we please move on then to the second question in this area from the Honourable MacPherson?
Thank you. One of the functions of the Commission is to advise the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation. In your opinion, what are some of the challenges in the implementation of the legislation as it is now? Are there any issues or areas that you maintain should be brought to the immediate attention of the Minister?
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. First of all, I must thank this legislature for listening to the cry from the public to change the then legislation into a new legislation. In my own view, when advising the Minister on the efficacy of the legislation, what comes to my mind is that the legislation mentions something like political parties. In that clause, you find political affiliations. Now, the problem is political affiliations are NPOs, NGOs, APLA MVA, you know, organizations that have got a political linking with a political party. The problem is that if the legislation is not scrutinized thoroughly, the commission has to depend on the opinion. And there are many people who are taking us to court because of the ambiguity of such a clause. For example,
which clause is this?
I may not mention the relevant clause, but where the Act talks about political parties, we understand it is true. We can't fund a political party, but we can give it a fundraising number to fundraise according to the prescribed norms and standards within the Act. The other one, honourable member, is the activities. The Act says activities which are done outside South Africa, outside the borders of South Africa, cannot be funded. Here is a question. You have SASCOC, which must go to the Olympics. So if you fund it, somebody can come and play, foul to say, no, you shouldn't have funded them because they are operating outside. There are people that can go and make the name of South Africa proud outside South Africa. So such a law needs, such a clause needs to be defined so that at least we do understand. The other aspect that I can raise with the minister is the organ of state organ, you know, NPOs, you name National Heritage Council, SARA, and whatever. Those are the state organs that get appropriation from this parliament. And according to their registration, they are NPOs. The current Act says, except educational and welfare institutions. Now, the problem arises if SARA or National Heritage Council applies to do a genuine project that has got welfare and educative aspects within it. We are barred to fund it. Of course, as I said in the first question, one of the advice to the minister is to check whether 47% of the charity, is it too small or is it too big. We must also make sure that we fund projects that can impact. We have signed a contract with the local government association, traditional leaders. We need to advise the minister that the project that we are funding, at least Western Cape local government knows about it, the traditional leader or the councillor of the ward knows about it. If it is Eastern Cape, all those stakeholders must be involved, because if we just fund organizations, they are going to do projects that may not have an impact. And I think Parliament will say, what have you done for the past 5 years? We need to fund for impact.
Thank you, Professor. And then we come through to the Honourable Kalako's question.
Thank you, Chair. Briefly, what would you identify as 5-year strategic objectives for the Commission? What system or process would you implement to monitor and evaluate the progress made in achieving these objectives?
Thank you, Honorable Kalako. Chairperson, maybe just a benefit of doubt to say, because it may not happen that I come back. The 12-month cooling off period in the Act poses serious questions, because we fund according to tranches. If you pay tranche number one and you pay tranche number two after 6 months or after 8 months, where do you start counting month number one, number two, number three, until number 12? So we think that because maybe next week you're going to hear that organizations are marching to towards the NLC because of that clause. But coming back to Honorable Kalako's question, the 5-year objectives of the NLC, I will say, let us make sure that the administration and support services is intact. Let's enhance it in order to make sure that the NLC delivers according to its mandate and within the prescripts of the policy, the prescripts of the law, which is in operation. The other one is grant funding. We must make sure that we enhance grant funding. We must educate people about grant funding and service delivery. How many months do we? How many months after receiving the application? How can we rejuvenate the grant funding in order to adhere to the stipulation of the law? We must also look at the enhancement of the financial aspect of the NLC. NLC is in the business of receiving money from the operator. Therefore, you must have a board that makes sure that the money they receive, they must invest it properly. I'm happy that during my tenure, we convinced the department and the minister to come up with the investment strategy that made us to take the very same money that I received in APSA, National, FNB, Standard, and whatever. We have put it in line with what the government is doing in the PIC in order to accrue the correct and relevant interests. In this question, we must also look at the ICT. We are no longer living in 1950s. We are living in the modern days. Application has to be online to areas where they can apply online. Where they cannot apply online, yes, we have offices in the 9 provinces. There are 9 offices where people can go and submit their applications. But what I'm saying is that the ICT is a requirement. Is a requirement that must be followed. We must also look at the issue of the management. We must have serious management that can work in accordance with the law.
Thank you, Professor Eviotondo. There's just one issue which perhaps you could expand on, clarify, the issue of the tranches. Let us leave aside appointments and all of this, but if you can just explain the technical hiccup about the disbursement of funds through tranches, whether it's 2 or 3, because it was not clear to me, but it seemed that you were saying, you know, a hiccup could occur. I want to know what this hiccup is. And then it would stop, as it were. Could you just clarify this disbursement? Leave the issue of appointments out. Let's get to the technical aspect. Because presumably there's still a CFO there, you know, and so on. Right.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I understand the intention of the Act. The intention of the Act and the drafters was to say many people apply at the same time. Therefore, we cannot fund all of them. The fund cannot accommodate all of them. Let's rather give organizations a cooling off time. If you have applied now, it means, because according to how the grant funding works. If you have applied for 10 million, because we don't know, you know, on paper trail, we can see that you do have a capacity to manage your finances. But we've come to realize that we can't give the organization the whole 10 million. We must give it in tranches. If we give you 4 million, then you must go and use that 4 million. After using it, you give us the report. In other words, approving 10 million does not mean that I'm going to get 10 million. It means if I am a truant child, it will end up at the first 4 million. Or we may recall it, we may institute legal actions against you to say, pay it back. So that clause gives us a problem because we don't know whether a grant becomes a grant during the first tranche, which may disorganize how we're working. So if we say a grant becomes a grant after the last tranche, it means that organization is going to stay, it is going to wait for 12 months after the third tranche or after the second tranche. So what the organizations are raising is that this is not on. It means I will wait for 12 months without a grant, without applying. So we are saying the best way is for the legislators to allow us to count 12 months the moment the distributing agency says you are getting 10 million.
Thank you. Right. And then we have the Honourable Van Schalkwyk's question.
Thank you, Chairperson. A question four, I'll give over to Honourable Hugh Lewis, so I'll ask question three. When advising the Minister on the allocations for the various categories of good causes, what factors would you take into consideration?
The word good causes, one has to make sure that the NLC or the board, in order to convince themselves that this is a good cause, they must commit a thorough research whether it is a good cause, because a good cause may tend to be a bad cause after 2 days or after 3 months. I think honorable members who were there during when I was appointed, you remember the 1 million that we gave to the COSATU. It tends to be a bad cause because it was understood as the NLC having done something which is wrong. So it means we must make sure that monitoring and evaluation within the National Lottery Commission must go and inspect the area. They must look at, in the form there are referees, they must phone the referees whether they know this project, whether they know this person, because people are applying just mentioning referees who are not even aware of the project. I remember last year I stopped 60 million which was going into the drain. How? Because when the commissioner tipped me that this grant, I am not comfortable, I phoned the applicant, which was a crèche, mothering an organization that must mother the crèche. When I phoned the person. He was the pastor. I said, do you know these people? He said, I don't know them. I said, who are these people? He said, no, they are, it's a mother, a child, and a son. Then I said, no, do you know what it means? Because this is a gazetted form. You can be arrested. And we stopped that allocation and put it back to the NLC. So I think what the advice that one should give the minister is to say there are different categories of good causes. Charity is one of them, arts is one of them, sport is one of them. Let's look at what the project wants to do. Is it aligned to our NDP? Is it aligned with the ministerial priorities? Because there are ministerial priorities that have been gazetted long ago, which says at least of the grant, 50% must go to a rural areas.
I must apologize to members and yourself. I got them just a little confused here. My apologies to the Honourable Kalaku. Are you then going to come in on if government's challenges, Honourable Kalaku? Because it's just been a straight swap between the two. I then had number 4 for the Honourable Van Schalkwyk. Those are the two I got mixed up with. But if it's not a compulsory issue, so let us move on, right?
So if there were to be governance challenges that arise between the Commission and the distributing agencies, how would you as the chairperson address those governance challenges?
Thank you, Honourable Lewis. I think as an old member, you know that during the previous act, it was difficult to understand what the board must do. But with the act that you promulgated, it's very clear. If there is governance challenge within the distributing agency, for example, if a member is conflicted, it can be a perceived conflict or a direct conflict. The Act says that member, immediately when you realize that you are conflicted, you must inform the board through the chairperson. Within 7 days, you must write a letter to the commission and as well as to the minister to inform him about this perceived or a direct conflict of interest. Well, the other challenge which you must also look at is the appointment of the distributing agency. I'll combine it with your question. The distributing agencies are appointed by the minister and they are full-time now. They don't report to the minister. They report to the commission. So therefore, the framework, the governance framework of the commission takes precedent. Because they are now, they look like officials of the NLC. So they are governed by the governance framework of the commission. For example, they've signed the contract with the commission, and in the contract, it stipulates anything that may arise in your operation, because you are in the NLC, make sure that you report it to the commissioner, who will then inform the board that there is a governance issue. The other thing that I remember when I came to Parliament to report, the other thing that I initiated before this new act was the Appeal Advisory Committee. By then, we wanted to make sure that if there is any conflict, the application should go to a different structure, because you are all aware that I once reported that when a person is conflicted, it's either he tells a person next to him to say, my project is coming. Look, make sure that you also assist. I will assist yours. That was the problem of the past. But now, it means if somebody is conflicted, he must step down, he must not participate in the decision-making of that project. And that project, according to governance principles of the NLC, that project must be taken, if it is arts, it must be taken to sport, for the sport to adjudicate, because they don't know that person. They don't know that organization. That's how I can answer your question.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up, Honorable Moses? No. Thank you. Now, we're going to go on to leadership now. These are not the technical qualities, but other qualities. And I just want to ensure I'm on track. It'll be the Honorable MacPherson, followed by the Honorable Van Schalkwyk. Just looking, followed, you see, this is the thing again, by the Honorable Hill Lewis. And we actually had similar amounts being allocated to each person here. This was part of my problem. So perhaps would you take that one then? Because we've got one, the Honourable MacPherson, then the Honourable Van Schalkwyk, and then number four would be the Honourable MacPherson. You see?
Yeah, Chair. Question three, Chair, I've already asked if you notice, and the chap that asked it, yes. And then, yes, that's what took you out of
Okay. Well, look, we're fortunate that we're all still on board and on track. It's merely a technicality. Do we accept that?
Yeah.
Right. So then we've already asked that one question there, so let's move on then to yourself, Honourable MacPherson, asking the first question under leadership.
Thank you very much. Professor, what experience do you currently have in terms of board memberships or senior level management?
Thank you, Honorable MacPherson. I'm erroneously the current chairperson of the NLC board. Let me start here. At the NLC, I learned how to adjudicate. I learned how to appoint the senior staff members. The current CEO has been appointed under my tenure. The executives that I spoke about have been appointed under my tenure. But the most important thing that I learned as the chairperson of the NLC board is to spearhead the request for proposal of the third national lottery license. That license was not drafted by anybody from overseas. That license was not drafted by a consultant. It was drafted by a board that I chair because we wanted to make it an African license. It was not easy. This is the tender of 85 billion. I was able to chair the board in adjudicating that 85 billion tender. And I'm proud, even if I may not be the chairperson tomorrow, I'm proud that this is the tender from government that the opponent never won any case. what the board did, the assessment and the evaluation, the paper-wise was very, very clean and very clear. So the judges, I think four times, they never found any fault within the tender that we've put forward and which now is in place.
Thank you, Professor. The Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Professor, how do you understand the difference between the roles of the Commissioner and the Board? And what is the relationship, according to you, between the Board, the Minister, and Parliament? Thank you.
The Commissioner is the administrator. Her function is to give administration. She must make sure that the administration is tight, it doesn't have loopholes. Her function is operational. Her function is to make sure that when the board meets, she come up with the report of the commission to the board. She is an accounting officer in terms of the NLC. The board is the body that controls the commission. Sorry, I didn't switch my phone.
Please switch it off, Professor.
Okay, thank you. So the board is the overall entity or the overall authority of the commission. The minister is the executive authority over the commission. Parliament legislates, because once Parliament legislates, the minister gives directives to the board, and the board gives direction to the commissioner, and the commissioner implements the directives.
Thank you very much. So now we have to then go straight through to, it's yourself, the Honourable MacPherson. The Honourable MacPherson, are you ready there on the leadership one?
Briefly, what would you identify? Oh, sorry, it's number four, sorry. Sorry. How would you ensure that realistic targets for the commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
The commission as an entity with its board, the board gives directives in terms of the policy of the commission. The commissioner, in order to implement the policy, she must have annual performance plans. She must draw the annual performance plans. In that annual performance plans, there is what we call, which we may ask if she just give us the annual performance plans, is that, is the annual performance plans being assured? Because in the NLC Commission, there is an internal audit who must give an assurance to that plan. Remember, the plan comes from the strategy of the board, where the commissioner, from that strategy, draws the operational strategy, how she's going to achieve this target. All these targets will have to be approved by the board, and after being approved by the board, they must be sent to Department of Trade and Industry for minister to check what we say we want to do and the minister will say, I'm satisfied with all your targets. So there are the external assurance that must check what the commissioner does, and the internal assurance that must also give us comfort that we are on the right track. So this thing must be periodically be assessed, quarterly be submitted to the Department of Trade and Industry.
Yes. Thank you very much. Would you like a follow-up, Honourable MacPherson? I hope everyone's sort of applying their minds here. I know that you're leaving any minute as well. Thank you, Professor. We then move on to community development. We've tackled the general issues, the technical, the leadership. Now, community development, and we'll turn to, with respect to community development, the Honourable Kalaku.
Maybe not to dwell on this question, since you are the incumbent, you are in the position. I'll ask it differently. You can briefly maybe tell us on how you make sure that the discretionary fund is utilized in a balanced manner or in a sustainable manner. But to me, I would want you to give us practical approach, not just as an example, practical examples of projects which, since your period, have been established. You can see, we can point and say, these are the projects which will reflect delivery on our party's government.
Thank you, Honorable Kalaku. I will be honest on this question. The mistake I regret until now is to give 30 million to the so-called kissing party. Honorable Lewis knows about it. That is something that I regret in my life, because it was not used with the intention it deserved. To come back to your question, Honorable Kalaku, in the Act, there is no discretionary fund. I think it might be a mistake. There is a miscellaneous fund, which is now 2%. Now, with this miscellaneous, what we did, during my time, it was 5%. And there was a lot of money, because since its inception, they never distributed money from that miscellaneous fund. One, during 2010, together with the sport and recreation, we allocated 171 million to build artificial turfs, that is small stadia, 27 in the whole country. With the very same miscellaneous, we have built a state-of-the-art hostel in a farm school in Free State. If you have got time, we can show you what it did. With the miscellaneous fund, together with charity fund, we have requested the minister to allow us to take 570 million to build more than 200 state-of-the-art ECD centers. I think I've sent Hermans the pictures of those things that you can go and observe them. with the miscellaneous fund, we make sure that we go to the community that is so poor. For example, now we are building rehab centers. We have identified Western Cape as a province that needs at least two rehab centers. One will be at Langa, one will be at Mitchell's Play. Why? How do we do this? We send people to go and make a research. We are now finishing a rehab center in Gauteng, Pretoria, Esterhaz. We are also going to build another one in El Dorado. So, during my tenure, we were mindful of when we distribute funds to everybody, but we must also look at areas that are hard hit. During the disaster, I think it was 2 years ago, from the very same fund, we gave disaster management 50 million to help the farmers to create ways in their farms and waters. Last year, with these funds, we were able to go to provinces that are hard hit by drought. Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Northern Cape, and Northwest. We have built boreholes to the communities. And these boreholes are associated either with the office of the municipality or the school, so that they cannot vandalize it. We have recently built the state of art school with only 25 million. It costs our government more than 100 million to build one school. We have built that school in Vuani, where it was burnt. There was no more school. We've built that school together with laboratory science with 25 million, chairs, offices, tiles, and everything with only 25 million, and we're able to build it in 2 months.
Thank you very much, Professor. Perhaps just a general issue here, question. Clearly, I mean, as the incumbent, you are very familiar with the position, the post, etc. But you've already pointed to one or two areas that definitely require the attention of the legislature to be changed, and that this has been pointed out to the minister. Can you indicate just one point, one issue that you think we could improve in terms of our proactive funding and identification?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The area that at least we have already started doing it now is to capacitate our research component, so that the research component can tell us where should we proactively fund. In fact, the ECD centers I'm talking about, it is as a result of proactive funding. And we are very happy that legislators, parliament, has inserted the clause that says we don't have to wait for somebody to apply. If we believe that there is a need in this community, we quickly summon the research component within the NLC to go and do a research and come back with the information and the way we can intervene. So that is the good side. In fact, the best way of making sure that the fund that we have is equitably shared amongst the communities of the broader South Africa. It enables us to even spot farms or people who are who are suffering, to go and create a project for people to be employed so that they can get money and buy bread and put it on the table. So proactive funding, I will say, Chairperson, we must have a thorough research so that we don't regret like I'm regretting. Had we had a research during the time of giving the kissing party money, the research would have come back and say, no, don't give them that much. Just assist them with 5 million or 3 million. But then, because we didn't have a research, the then act didn't have the powers that that must agree with us. Again, because the current act does not have enforcement powers, it is something that we are still trying. Even if somebody has embezzled the money, we must depend on outside law agencies to apprehend that person. We can go to Hawks, but if they are delaying, we don't have any more power to take action against the illegal lotteries and against the person who has done wrong.
Professor, thank you very much for availing yourself to be nominated. Oh, sorry, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Yes, I just have one general question for me. Thank you, sir. The one response that the one concern that I've raised with you in the past that that you will know about is the exposure of the commission and the distributing agencies to political influence and the use of the money for causes closely associated with political parties or individuals who are closely associated with political parties. And I would like to know if you are reappointed, what you will do to ensure that those governance mechanisms are strengthened so that the funds are not abused for political benefit for any political party in South Africa.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Lewis. I can confirm, yes, you have raised it with me several times. The ICT that we are putting in place is part of enhancing governance within the NLC. We are making sure that anyone who applies, because I'll be fair, Honorable Lewis, we may not, you know, perhaps I may know, but others may not even know that this person is connected to a political party. So what we are envisaging doing is to make sure that even IDs of applicants, those people that are directors within within that that application, we need to form alliance with the register of companies in the DTI to check whether these people are having problems and the like. You know that we once got into trouble when a Zimbabwean applied, it was in the media, because we didn't know. So we are putting systems in place to identify areas where we could be lacking. And I can be rest assured that if the distributing agencies, most especially because now the distributing agencies are full-time, they will make a lot of inquiries. They've got more time to sit in the office. Otherwise, it's better for them to come 2 days per week. But they are reporting to NLC from Monday to Friday, and the hours is 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock. So they will be able to investigate who are the individuals. Are you indirectly connected to any other party? Although it is very, I must say, it is very difficult. A person might say, yes, I was a member of the PAC, I was a member of the ANC, but I'm no longer the member of the ANC, I'm no longer the member of DA or UDM. But care must be taken that any form of soliciting money from lottery to political party persuasions is prohibited. That's why some of the applications will be able to make sure that the security state agency must look at who are these members. How is he, if his name is big, and what, who connects with who? It's a difficult question, I understand, but I think we'll navigate to be a clean organization.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thank you for, agreeing to be nominated again, but also for the time you've spent here with us. Thank you very much indeed. You may leave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, what we will do now is, I've already indicated, we're not going to discuss this. I think we've agreed, have we? That we're going to digest this, come back next week, and probably on Friday will be the time when we could do this again, next Friday. And meanwhile, we consult with our political parties, etc. We've got to come back, though. So how do you want to deal with it? You know, because until we do come back, it should be considered confidential. Yeah, I think we should have them in. If we do we agree on that? Yes. And then we'll come back to it. I should just note, Honourable Hilderus, it wasn't only the community development. The community development is effectively five, and it's not only, I'm not only talking, of course, to the Honourable Hilderus, and the overall assessment is five, so that the two together are 20. They take. You remember you raised the issue under community development. Okay. Yes, do go and don't have an accident. Go carefully. All right. But for the rest now, what I'm going to do right now is adjourn the meeting, but I would like to see our lawyer, our parliamentary legal advisor here, please. Thank you. We're adjourning this meeting Friday.